From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, Milwaukee philanthropist Sheldon Lubar talks government reform, education, and Milwaukee's future. Later, a Milwaukee library adds time capsule curation to its mission.
We moved out of our old building and we had a lot of really cool, funky stuff that we got rid of and sold to get ready to move. And I was like, oh, we lost all that stuff. But really what you want your time capsule to be is a snapshot of life that is going on right now.
An in-studio performance by The Trues. And the headaches of being a 12-year-old root beer float magnet.
Tracking expenses and, like, planning our supplies and just, like, money, like, how much certain things it will cost.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's great to have you listening today. In the last few years, philanthropist Sheldon Lubar has made headlines for his outspoken views on reforming Milwaukee County government. And in fact, many of the changes at the Board of Supervisors level are going into effect, though their effects are yet to be measured. It's been a very public political stand for someone who has never held elected office himself, though he did serve in the administrations of Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and Jimmy Carter. But Lubar, who grew up first in Sherman Park and later Whitefish Bay before founding his private investment company, Lubar & Company, has never really left Milwaukee behind. And in fact, his stamp is firmly affixed here in places like the business school at UW-Milwaukee, which carries his name. We sat down for a wide-ranging interview with Lubar in the latest in a series of conversations recorded at the University Club of Milwaukee. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
When you think of the Milwaukee that existed as you grew up, you started your life in Sherman Park, if I'm not mistaken, and then moved to Whitefish Bay. And then you look at the Milwaukee that's out there today. What successes do you see in where we are as a city, and what are the missed opportunities?
Well, when I grew up in the 1930s, living on Sherman Boulevard across the street from Sherman Park, and I went to Townsend Street grade school through fourth grade. This was the center of the Depression. That was a depression. And I would say if you had a job working at Schuster's department store, you were probably earning $20 a week. And you were supporting yourself and your family. And there were no safety nets. There was a little north of Townsend Street School, a public housing, but the people in public housing were working, and everybody was, by most standards, poor but supporting themselves.
And so you look today, and if it weren't so foggy, we could probably almost see to that part of the city. Probably not very many safety nets exist there today for many of those people as well. What are the opportunities that that have been missed in terms of moving an area like that? I mean, things got better after the Depression, but for many people in the time since then, things have gotten worse.
Well, what happened was that World War II started, and there was a shortage of workers, and Milwaukee had heavy industry companies. They had A.O. Smith that produced things for the military, and there was more than full employment. You had a lot of people from the South coming into the industrial cities. I think Wisconsin and Milwaukee in particular have been known as manufacturing centers, and they still are. We are as a state of 5.5 million people, a state that is largely manufacturing. We shouldn't forget that. Things have changed, of course, and they've certainly changed in terms of the federal government providing Social Security. Social Security was first developed in the early 30s by FDR and the New Deal. And You know, of course, we have a very deep coverage now in the area of medical help and other support. I mean, it's absolutely, totally different.
You served in the Nixon, the Ford, and the Carter administrations. That was a time when there was partisanship in government, but things still got accomplished. When you look at the political climate today, it's still partisan, and things are not necessarily getting accomplished, at least to the same degree. What's different about politics today, do you think?
Well, I think you stated the situation. I know when I was recruited to come to Washington to work on the National Housing Review of 1973, which we did, and it ultimately resulted in legislation in September of 1973 that is basically still the housing law of the land today. And we had a discredited Republican president, and we had a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House, and that legislation was passed. And I like to think that a large part of getting it passed was Congressman Henry Rice from Milwaukee, who I knew, who was the number two man on the two or three on the House Banking and Housing Subcommittee. He was an honest, upright, highly intelligent man, and he wanted to do things that were right and right for the country. And I wish we had more people like that in Congress now, instead of just being looking out for their own ideas of how governance would be if they were the dictator.
Do you think that piece of legislation could have passed today?
No. No, I don't. The problem is, in a democracy, compromise is the integral activity. You have one thought on how things should be done, I have another. It isn't you're right and I'm wrong. It is that we have to sit down and negotiate it to a reasonable outcome.
You have been outspoken in your desire to reform county government. What is it about that layer of government that raises your ire the most?
Well, I think the thing that got me involved initially was the fiscal crisis, that the county had accumulated $2.5 billion of debt, that the county was running a deficit, whereas it's the largest component of the county, Milwaukee, seemed to have been run well. I mean, they had no debt to speak of. They had a pension fund that was fully funded. The county pension fund was far from, nor is it today, fully funded. And the city did not run a deficit. And the city was not overpaying its members on the Common Council and having excessive retirement benefits. And I just thought it was outrageous. And it led to the recall of County Exec Tom Ament. It led to the recall of certain supervisors. But it didn't lead to the reform of the board itself. We saw recently there was a referendum to return the county board of supervisors basically to a part-time job, which is how it exists in the other 71 or 72 counties in the state. We're the only ones that have full-time high paid, and the pay was cut in half, and the staffs were reduced. So that's what attracted me.
What would you believe is going to be the upshot of those changes? What should the county now be able to accomplish that potentially wasn't being accomplished because of this layer of bureaucracy?
Whether the structure of the county governance is such that it can exist is a question. Because this board of supervisors and working with Chris Abley, the county exec, and the one that was working with Scott Walker, have this same situation that you described in Congress, where one side really feels that it's their job to see that the other side can do nothing. And that's really what happens. There's this hostility that goes on there as opposed to a cooperative feeling. The hope would be that the Board of Supervisors and the county exec could work together, could negotiate together, could come out with a result that really produces what the citizens deserve and what the citizens are paying for. And I think, you know, we can be critical of Milwaukee, but I think in general, the Common Council and the mayor have found a way to work together. I'd like to see the mayor being responsible for the Milwaukee public school system, the way the mayor is in other cities. And I think the governance of the Milwaukee public school systems is the biggest problem we have in this county.
Is there any, along these lines, is there any getting civility back into politics? Does it take a remarkable leader to kind of bring it back? Does the county board and the county executive need, do they need to go to therapy together?
It's a good suggestion. Probably required. I think there's this attitude, I mean, that I sense with the Board of Supervisors. They're ambitious people, and they think that their way is the only way. It isn't a cooperative effort. To achieve it, you do need a strong leader. You can go along and bump along and not see the progress that you know, some of us see in a city like Chicago that has had the strong leadership in the past and even now. And I hope we do get to a point where we can say we have that.
You have served on the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents. Your name is on the business school at UWM and on this pen that I'm holding. So let me ask you a higher education question. As UWM has started its search for a new chancellor, what should the university be looking for in a new leader, and what direction do you think UWM needs to move at this point in time?
The University of Wisconsin system, I have said, and I believe, is the most important institution in the state. 13 universities, 13 two-year colleges, an extension in every county in the state, great research coming out of Madison, research also beginning and coming and developing here in Milwaukee. I think Milwaukee has a huge opportunity to, and it is fulfilling it. I mean, the business school has more graduates every year. I mean, this is the largest business school in the state. It's larger than what is in Madison. And it's touched a lot of people. It's provided leaders in a lot of the bigger companies in town, and perhaps most important, it's provided a lot of leadership for smaller businesses. So it has a huge responsibility, and it has provided leadership. And it will. Some of us feel that we want to see the campus spread into the center of the city and not just where it is. Because, you know, the path to a good life is through education. And that means we have to get education on the primary K-12 level to a level that doesn't require remediation, which it does today, to say nothing of the fact that perhaps no more than half of the people in K-12 in Milwaukee do graduate. That is the measure of the wealth of a nation. It isn't GMP. It will be. You will have high GMP. It is what is the level of education of the citizenry.
Do you think UWM has a role to play in elevating the K-12 situation in this city?
I think it does. I think all of the universities in the state do, but especially Milwaukee. The people out there in the schools are largely products of these 13 universities. Most of the teachers have graduated from one of them. And I think that I think what's lacking is the governance of the K through 12s, absolutely in Milwaukee and throughout the state to some level. I can't tell you, I'm not familiar, but I am familiar with what Milwaukee has produced. I think the parent teachers associations and principals and everyone else wants to get in, should get in and involved in the problem and do something about it. The police chief wants things to develop differently. It has to have leadership.
Well, and as we said, UWM is looking for a new chancellor. At the same time, Milwaukee Public Schools are searching for a new superintendent. So do you see, is there an opportunity at this stage?
Big, absolutely. I think we'll have a chancellor that will recognize their role. I think Mike Lovell recognized his role, and I'm glad to see that he's at Marquette, which is an important ingredient in this whole equation.
What gives you the most satisfaction in what you do today?
I think meeting with the students that are at the Lubar Business School or at the Medical College of Wisconsin, who at Marquette that we may have sponsored with scholarships. And it's very gratifying to feel that you're offering a helping hand to someone who is working to be a productive part of our community.
And I don't know, do we have any additional questions from the audience?
What led you to make such a major gift to the UW School of Business?
Kanti Prasad was the dean. Eric Schenker had come before him, and he's the one that drew me in, and I'd worked with the business school. And the at that time, the chancellor was Carlos Santiago, and they came over and asked me. And I said, okay. It was just about that simple. I said, I do have to consult with my wife. I was really so happy to do it. And we'll do more.
Well, Sheldon Lubar, I thank you so much for spending some time with us and sharing this part of your story.
Thank you.
Sheldon Lubar is a Milwaukee native, founder and chairman of the private investment firm Lubar & Company. We spoke with him in the latest in a series of interviews recorded in front of an audience at the University Club of Milwaukee. In an increasingly digital world, why a new library goes old school with a physical time capsule? That story when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Libraries are known to be a treasure trove of information, new and old. Although the role the library plays in today's society is shifting, Milwaukee public libraries are currently building a new physical space on the east side. Opening in November, the library's construction is at a point where the librarians could put something in the walls. The librarians of the East Library decided to put a time capsule in that space. It was placed in the walls Friday, June 20th. Harper Robeson, a circulation assistant, and Beth Gabriel, a reference assistant, join Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson by phone as they tell us why they chose to do a time capsule of physical items while we're living today's digitally dominant society.
Well, you know, it was something that we thought of just recently, actually. We're at a part in the construction process where if we wanted to put anything in the walls, we needed to decide pretty quickly what it was, how big it was, and what we wanted to put in there. And even though it's a digital age, we still use a ton of paper products. We use digital items like mice and MP3 players and jump drives. So we thought, hey, why not put something together that shows what library life is right now in 2014? And we're also trying to plan ahead. We're going to have 4 new libraries being built in the next couple years, and we'll put one in every one of our new buildings.
Wow. What is the time frame for them to open up the time capsule in the future? Are you hoping for 50 years, 100 years, 10 years?
Well, we really hope that the time capsule will just hang out in the building until the building is no longer a library, which we hope it will be for a very, very long time, maybe 100 years, maybe 200.
Yes.
And then when they're tearing it down, they can look at what's in there.
Right, because there's really that big debate right now about the place that the institution of a library has within today's society and future society. Is it going to become a glorified computer lab, or are they just going to become abandoned buildings? You know, so I think it's a really interesting debate. But for whenever this time capsule is going to be opened up, what are they going to find?
Well, you know, I really did some research on this because we moved out of our old building and we had a lot of really cool, funky stuff that we got rid of and sold to get ready to move. And I was like, oh, we lost all that stuff. But really what you want your time capsule to be is a snapshot of life that is going on right now. So we really just talked to the group, and then I picked a bunch of stuff that we use every day, you know, from our code of conduct to the Dewey Decimal System, you know, bookmark where we find books now, because who knows, in 100 years, are we going to be using Dewey? Or is it all going to be icons? I don't know.
True. And then I heard that Harper had put something rather interesting in his in the time capsule for his contribution.
Yeah, I was asked if I had any ideas on what we should put in the time capsule, and jokingly, I suggested we put 50 Shades of Grey in, and it actually made it in. you know, just in case it doesn't become a cornerstone of modern American literature, the future will be able to have that.
Yes, a true representation of our society.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and, you know, subject of many, many library jokes.
Oh, yeah.
Little library humor for everyone out there.
So do you think that the people who will open this up in maybe 50 to 100 years are going to know what the items are in the time capsule? What are your thoughts on that?
I really tried, when I was researching time capsules, I learned that you always need to put an inventory list within the time capsule to kind of explain what everything is. So we did do that. So I hope my explanations will, you know, kind of help them. Will they be able to actually look at the photos that we have on the jump drive? I don't know. Maybe the technology will be gone, but it'll tell them that that's what's on there. We did put a real photograph of our staff at the time of the closing of the old library, so at least they'll get to see that. And it is in an interior wall of the library, so it shouldn't get too damaged by any sort of water or harsh Wisconsin winters.
Good. So you're keeping up with the librarian preservation ethics and ideals there.
Exactly. And then through my research, we also discovered there's an international time capsule society located in Georgia at Oglethorpe University. And we're going to register our time capsule with their society. And we'll make sure that not just the library knows about it, but the whole world, technically. So if anyone wants to come find it in a couple hundred years, they'll know where to look.
Is there going to be a kind of a plaque or some designation that says that the time capsule is within this wall right here?
Yeah, we're going to do something. It's located when you're going to walk into the new entrance of the library, which is on Kramer Street. It'll be directly inside the building to the left, and we'll put some sort of plaque on the wall. We haven't really decided what that'll look like yet.
It'll be right near the checkout desk.
And what was the container you decided to use for the time capsule?
Well, I went to a hardware store, and I wasn't really sure. I was given, you know, it had to be kind of small because it had to fit between the two different layers of drywall. And my choice was either a shoebox-sized Tupperware container or the empty paint can. And I went with the paint can because it looked more time capsule-y to me, silver, and you could pound the lid on pretty tightly and get a good seal on there. So that really also determined what we could fit inside.
As librarians, how has the adjustment been for you running a library out of a temporary, much smaller location than the library that you were once at and the library you're going to be going into? I mean, you're kind of in cramped quarters in a way.
Yeah, you know, we were a little worried about the size of the temporary library, but, you know, the architects did an amazing job piecing this place together and designing it to really be a great tiny little collection of what people really want right now. And if we don't have it right here on our shelf, we can order it for you from somewhere in the county. It takes 3 days, and we'll get you whatever you want. And honestly, I kind of really love it, and there's a lot of things I'm going to miss about the tiny library, but I am excited to move into the new one as well. What about you, Harper?
Well, a lot of patrons have actually come in and told us they're going to be sad to see the temporary library go because they think it's so nice and cozy, small little spot. Pretty quiet here, so but it'll be a pretty interesting move from a small quiet spot to a huge hustle and bustle and new library.
And as a reference staff, Beth, how is it with answering questions? If you don't have that one reference book there, are you finding new ways to answer the questions? Are you making do? Are you referring them to something else? Or are you hoping that they come back in 3 days once the interlibrary loan transaction happens between the libraries?
Yeah, you know, a lot of our patrons, they were concerned as well because, you know, we did have to store a lot of our collection over at Central Library. You can go visit our books on the second floor in the periodicals room. I think one of the collections that people miss the most is our music CD collection, which is also at Central Library, and we'll be getting it back when we move into the new library. There was a few, you know, disappointed people, but overall, people have been very understanding, and we're a big hold pickup location. We always have been. People are very well versed at using our catalog and putting what they want on hold. So really hasn't been too bad. We have so many great digital resources now that I really myself haven't had a problem answering most questions, and Central Library is always just a phone call away.
Give us an update on how the East Library is coming along, and when is the tentative grand opening?
Well, we are very excited. We are now able to tell people that the end of November is going to be, this year is when we'll be opening at the new library, so that's, what, 5 months?
Yeah.
Can't even believe it. We just had our one-year anniversary here at Temp East, and it feels like yesterday we were moving in and doing the closing party, and then yesterday we had our opening day planning committee party happen, so we had a big meeting. Yeah, and then we're starting to get the collection ready, starting to think about what we want to add to the collection, what kind of materials we'll have, and all sorts of good stuff. So it's sooner than we know it. And we just noticed the sign on our new building went up 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that'll be nice.
Really cool big carved sign. So they should check it out.
Great. And one of the neat features that I like about the library is that there will be apartments above the library. And it's just perfect for that avid reader.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then they can come on, get their movies, and go home and watch them.
Exactly. We can find out more information and progress updates through the East Library blog, correct?
Yeah. The plan is for all of our branch libraries to start blogging in the future. We are one of the first just because of the project, and we do update it all the time, so you should check it out. And then there's a really good photo album on Facebook as well. You can keep track of the progress.
Terrific, and we'll be seeing pictures of the staff, like Harper and you, Beth?
Yeah, staff in the building.
So many pictures.
Harper the Time Master.
There you go.
And then you can find that at www.mpl.org.
Wonderful. Harper and Beth, thank you so much for being on Lake Effect and telling us about the time capsule and the new updates with the East Library. We look forward to November.
We do too. Yeah,
thanks.
Harper Robeson and Beth Gabriel work at Milwaukee Public Library's East Library and play big roles in the time capsule that was recently placed in the new library's walls. The new East Library is scheduled to open in November of this year. They spoke with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson. Next up, some in-studio music from one of the bands that helped get Summerfest underway last week. We'll hear a live acoustic track from The Trues when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Summerfest is in full swing in the lakefront with hundreds of thousands coming in town over the festival's run to hear from 800 acts and around 1,000 performances. The lineup runs from such well-known acts as the Arctic Monkeys to Bruno Mars to Joan Jett to Rick Springfield. But for many bands, this is their first taste of the big gig. The Canadian band The Trues is well-known in Canada, but not a household name here. They played a smaller show at Shank Hall a couple of years back, but returned last week for their Summerfest date. Ahead of that, they played an unplugged set in our studio. We'll hear the full interview in the days to come, but for now, here is an acoustic version of Permanent Love from their newest album, The Trues.
Get away with murder.
The Trues are brothers Colin and John Angus McDonald, Jack Siparek, and Sean Dalton. They played Permanent Love in our Studio C1 ahead of their show last week at Summerfest. We'll hear the full interview in the days to come. One last break, and then the 12-year-old president and CEO of, well, not exactly a food truck, but maybe the next best thing, serving root beer floats to thirsty people in Pewaukee. Keep listening as Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Did you have a summer job when you were a kid? 12-year-old Noah Godsell has a summer job, and as a result, so do about a dozen of his friends and peers. The Pewaukee boy took the old-fashioned idea of selling drinks to thirsty people on a hot day and scaled it up. The result is Goat's Floats, which sells floats to people at Pewaukee's Wagner Park. Godsell honed his business acumen on the job, and through a class trip to a local program run by the organization Junior Achievement, Noah Godsell is with us in the studio to talk about his foray into small business, along with Tim Greiner, who is president of Junior Achievement of Wisconsin. Welcome to you both.
Glad to be here.
Glad to be here.
And I want to start with you and learn about how Goat's Floats was born.
Well, I was at my house, and I was bored. I didn't know what to do. And one day, I was messing with ice cream, and I just made this weird concoction. I'm like, I should do this and make it a stand. But then my mom said, oh, this probably could be too hard to make. And she's like, oh, why not just root beer floats? And I was like, sure, okay. And then we added in flavor of the day floats, and we started planning it and what other flavors we were going to have. And eventually when we just opened it, we just decided to do root beer floats because it's just a good start. And we sold like 20-some floats, and then we kept going, and all of a sudden now we're selling at least an average of like 40 floats a day. So.
And you do this at Wagner Park. Was your original plan to do it just out in front of your house, or how did you decide where the best place to sell floats was going to be?
We live right by the park, so we were afraid that like we would get in trouble with the park because we don't really have a permit. Shh. Okay. So then we just put it on like a corner of a hill that's like right by the park. Or if we got caught, we were just going to put it by our house and say, come over to Goat's Floats to the games by like going over and advertising, which we still do. So we're just like go on this corner of the hill and they just come up there. We just go to them and give them their floats.
A lot of thirsty people there.
Yeah.
Well, and I want to turn the clock back because if I understand right, you also went to something with your elementary school called BizTown. What was your trip to BizTown about and what was your experience there?
Well, at the beginning of fifth grade, they said we were going to BizTown and stuff, actually someone coming in and talk about you and your achievement. Well, I wanted to be like a CEO of some kind because it's more of like you go to the place and then you get a job and it's like a real job. That's the closest you're going to get in like five, six more years. And I was the CEO of the radio station and it was hard, but it was still fun at the same time because you're kind of telling them what to do. Like, I still want to keep doing this and I'm doing Goat's Floats now as a CEO.
You were learning what it was like to be a boss?
Yes. Tracking expenses and like planning our supplies and just like money, like how much certain things it will cost and how much profit you're going to make, how much does it cost for each float.
Tim Greiner, this all emerged from BizTown. What's the idea behind that program?
Well, Junior Achievement is an organization dedicated to giving young people exposure to entrepreneurial skills, to financial literacy skills. And JA BizTown is one of our newest programs that immerses young people like Noah into the learning process. JA BizTown features an in-school curriculum where the students learn about the economy and the role of businesses in the economy. And then they come out to the Junior Achievement Kohl's Education Center, which is a facility that houses J.A. Bizztown. And if you can think of a 10,000-square-foot simulated city, a very Disney-like appearance, but the students actually hold down careers. They run businesses. They learn what it's like to be a responsible citizen in an economy. And they also earn paychecks as part of that process and learn what it's like to be a good consumer. So they are exposed to the idea of running a business, entrepreneurship, and as Noah outlined, some of the expenses and challenges that go with running a successful business.
Well, and is the idea necessarily to turn everyone who goes through Bizztown into a future businessman or businesswoman, or is there something bigger picture that you're hoping people get, regardless of whether they go on to own their own business?
Yeah, I think what is important to us is that our young people see the correlation between their education at a young age and their future opportunities, but also just to give them the skill set. So the innovative entrepreneurial skill set, whether they run their own business or work for someone else's business, those are the type of workforce skills that are in demand in any career. So young people being exposed and being able to demonstrate those skills gives them a leg up on future opportunities in whatever pursuit they follow.
Noah, what have been the hardest parts about running Goats Floats?
Really bad days. Like if you had a really good day, like 40-plus floats, and all of a sudden the next day you just get like 25 and you're like, oh, come on, you can do better than that. And you just kind of pick your head up and keep going and still be happy. But, I mean, it can be pretty hard.
You're doing this to raise money for a charity, right? Not to put money in your own pocket. Why did you decide to do it that way rather than I'm going to go out and sell these ice cream floats, or root beer floats rather, and then I'm going to go buy a bike?
Well, last year, 10% went to our employees, 10% went to the charity, and 25% went to me. But this year, eventually so many people started coming that they've only gotten like 5 cents each day. So they're like, just put it in the box. And then
these are your employees?
Yes. Yeah. And eventually I had to start like taking out my share and give it to them, and they still got like 5 cents. And then I just started putting my stuff in the box. So at the end of the year, we're just like, we'll just do all of our profits, just go. And the last day, we just did like all of the money, like every dollar goes to the charity. And then we're just like, let's just do all profits. And
do you know how much money you made
that day? Like $108, I think.
How did you decide how to price these? You know, there's, I'm guessing, a lot that goes into, you know, first of all, picking the right employees, and you guys have T-shirts, I imagine. Those cost money to make, and your equipment that you use to make them, or at least the supplies that go into it. How big a deal was trying to figure out, like, the business end of this?
It's a beer float in a 16-ounce cup. And then it seemed like a reasonable price to just price it $1. And then when we total up all the money, it was 50 cents. So it just became $1.
Talk about how it works at Bizztown. How much failure do you allow student, you know, because these are things that kids don't necessarily get right away. Is part of the goal to show, you know, how things can go wrong?
You know, I think in any economy, and I think we probably have some real-life examples of that more recently, you know, in entrepreneurship, a lot of new businesses aren't successful right away, and it does take some time. And you heard Noah talk a little bit about persistence, that, hey, we didn't have as good a day, but we're going to keep going. So it's really teaching the skills through the simulation. But invariably, some businesses are challenged to pay back their bank loan and make a profit and make sure the employees are all paid by the end of their simulation. So those provide you know, that learning opportunity. Success is a great teacher, but sometimes failure is an even better teacher. So, you know, the focus at JA Bizztown is really about the skills and the experience and helping the young people learn from that experience, whether it is positive or negative.
Noah, is it hard being a boss?
Well, it can be fun, but it can be hard also. Being it hard-wise, you're more in charge and you have to be the leader. And sometimes you kind of just say, I want to take a break. I'm just bored. But if you want to take a break, just kind of put someone else in charge. But if you want to be the boss, you're going to have to be the leader. So you can't just go like, I'm going to take a break. You could take like a 1-minute break. That's fine. But at least try to be the leader. Don't really let like everyone else do it.
Do you have thoughts about what kind of business you might want to do next? Is that what you want to do with your life, or is there something else you're – I mean, you're still pretty young to decide what you want to be when you grow up, but
– Well, I'm really into baseball, so I kind of want to be a professional baseball player. But I'm going to try to continue this as long as possible, maybe hand it over to my brother. But if I want to get big in it, I actually will go big in it. So I will try to go as far as possible.
And if the baseball playing doesn't work out, maybe you could be a general manager.
Yeah, GM.
Well, Noah Godsell and Tim Greiner, thank you so much, both of you, and best of luck moving forward.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Tim Greiner is president of Junior Achievement of Wisconsin. Noah Godsell is the founder, president, and CEO of Goats Floats, which sells root beer and other floats just outside Wagner Park in Pewaukee, with proceeds benefiting the charity Living Hope International. You'll find a link to, yes, his website from WUWM.com/LakeEffect. Finally today, we're into the latter stages of the World Cup. Satirist and Lake Effect essayist Will Durst is excited by the whole phenomenon of international soccer.
Hey guys, Will Durst here with a few choice words about the World Cup, the most exciting sporting event on the face of the planet, as we've been told over and over again. Bigger than the Super Bowl and World Series put together. And go ahead, throw in the next Star Wars movie while you're at it. And we Americans should be congratulated for finally growing up and stopping with the mocking. Really? So what's the second most exciting sporting event on the planet? The Desert Tricycle Marathon Relay Seniors Division? We're more sophisticated now. Look at the huge leaps Major League Soccer has made in the last couple of years, easily propelling itself to the eighth or ninth most popular team sport in the country, right behind football, basketball, baseball, hockey, bowling, beach volleyball, water polo, and lacrosse, and maybe badminton, and in some regions, cow tipping and pie eating. But soccer, or football, really can be what Pele said, O jogo bonito, the beautiful game. We residents of the Estados Unidos just need to learn how to watch the damn thing. Number one, who to root for. Choose a team. Every match. Pick the land of your ancestors or the land next to the land of your ancestors or simply the underdog, which could be us. Number two, who to root against. Start with teams whose victory would impede your team's progress or just root against overbearing, bullying countries. Which, again, could be us. Isn't that right, Vladimir? Or go traditional and root against the Axis powers. Number three, you need a big-ass TV. The bigger, the better. 70 inches is a good start, because soccer is fond of cameras that are fastened to the inside edge of the International Space Station. Number four, the World Cup is meant to be watched with people, preferably a bar frequented by countrymen of the team that you're rooting for. Do some research. Stay away from wearing the opposing team's colors. And finally, if you do watch it at home, turn on Univision, not ESPN. The announcers are much more entertaining. You know the guy who goes, "Goal!" when someone scores? He does stuff like that all the time. A penalty when someone almost scores. Even when players trip and fall, clutching their face, which is not flopping. It's an injury simulation. For a Lake Effect, I'm Will Durst.
Writer, comedian, political satirist, and Lake Effect contributor Will Durst is a Milwaukee area native who now lives in California's Bay Area. He is the author of several books, the most recent of which is Elect to Laugh. That's all for the Monday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. It's so great to have you listening today. In fact, it's great to have you listening every day. We air every weekday morning at 10, weekend afternoons at 3 on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Coming up at 12 noon today from WBUR in Boston and NPR, it's Here and Now. Right now, though, it's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.